them. During the afternoon of August the 1st, a scouting vessel from Nelson's fleet signalled that a number of French battleships were anchored in Aboukir Bay, to the east of Alexandria. In a line nearly 2 miles long, the 13 French 74s lay close in to the shallow water, headed west, with dangerous shoals to port. The French Admiral Brouet was convinced that not even an English admiral would risk sailing his ship between the shoals and the French line. But Nelson knew his captains. As evening drew near, the Goliath, followed by the Zealous, cautiously crept to landward of the French van and came into action a few minutes before sundown. 5 British ships passed in succession on the land side of the enemy, while Nelson, in the vanguard, led the rest of his fleet to lie to on the starboard side of the French line. The French sailors were many of them on shore, and the decks of their vessels were encumbered with gear. They had not thought it necessary to clear the gun ports on their landward side. In the rapidly falling darkness, confusion seized their fleet. Relentlessly, the English ships, distinguished by 4 lanterns hoisted in a horizontal pattern, battered the enemy van, passing from one disabled foe to the next down the line. At 10 o'clock, Brouet's flagship, the Orient, blew up. The 5 ships ahead of her had already surrendered. The rest, their cables cut by shot, or frantically attempting to avoid the inferno of the burning Orient, drifted helplessly. In the morning hours, 3 ran ashore and surrendered, and a 4th was burned by her officers. Of the great fleet that had convoyed Napoleon's army to the adventure in Egypt, only 2 ships of the line and 2 frigates escaped. Nelson's victory of the Nile cut Napoleon's communications with France and ended his hopes of vast eastern conquests. He campaigned against the Turks in Syria, but was checked at Acre, where the defence was conducted by Sir Sidney Smith and a force of English seamen. In 1799, he escaped back to France, leaving his army behind him. The British fleet was once again supreme in the Mediterranean Sea. This was a turning point. With the capture of Malta in 1800 after a prolonged siege, Britain had secured a strong naval base in the Mediterranean, and there was no further need to bring the squadrons home for the winter, as in the early part of the war. But still the British government could conceive no coordinated military plan upon the scale demanded by European strategy. Their own resources were few, and their allies seldom dependable. Minor expeditions were dispatched to points around the circumference of the continent. Descents were made upon Brittany, in Spain, and later in southern Italy. These harassed the local enemy commanders, but scarcely affected the larger conduct of the war. Meanwhile, Napoleon again took charge of the French armies in Italy. In June 1800, he beat the Austrians at Marengo in Piedmont, and France was once more mistress of Europe. The main contribution of the island to the war at this time was the vigilance of her fleets and the payment of subsidies to allies. Napoleon's taunt of a nation of shopkeepers had some foundation. The time had not yet come when British troops were to distinguish themselves except by pinpricks and gadfly tactics. General Sir Ralph Abercrombie sourly remarked that there are risks in a British warfare unknown to any other army. He was soon to disprove the slur he thus cast on his troops by landing in Egypt and forcing the capitulation of the French. His victory at Alexandria in 1801, in which he was mortally wounded, offered the first light of dawn. The French were cleared from the Orient. In 1800, the political situation in Britain was dominated by the passing of the Act of Union with Ireland. The shocks and alarums of the previous years determined Pitt to attempt some final settlement in that troubled island. The concessions already won by the Irish from British governments in difficulty had whetted their appetite for more. At the same time, Irish Catholics and Protestants were at each other's throats. In Ulster, the Protestants founded the Orange Society for the defence of their religion. In the South, the party of United Irishmen under Wolfe Tone had come more and more in their desperation to look to France. Rebellion, French attempts at invasion, and brutal civil war darkened the scene. The hopes that had once been pinned in the independent parliament at Dublin faded away. Even by 18th-century standards, this body was shockingly corrupt. Pitt decided that the complete union of the two kingdoms was the only solution. Union with Scotland had been a success. Why not with Ireland, too? But the prime requisite for any agreement must be the emancipation of Irish Catholics from the disabilities of the penal laws. Here Pitt was to stumble upon the rock of the conscience of a monarch now half crazy. Unscrupulous backstairs influences, false colleagues within the Cabinet Council, pressed George III to stand by his coronation oath, which he was assured was involved. Pitt had committed himself to the cause of Catholic freedom without extracting a written agreement from the king. When George refused his assent on March 14, 1801, Pitt felt bound to resign. Catholic emancipation was delayed for nearly 30 years. The Act of Union had meanwhile been carried through the Irish Parliament by wholesale patronage and bribery against vehement opposition. Grattan made the greatest speech of his career against the Union, but in vain. Westminster absorbed the Irish members. Bitter fruits were to follow from this in the later 19th century. Pitt was worn and weary, and perplexed by the uncongenial task of organizing England for war. He has been blamed by later historians for his incapacity in directing an extensive war and for his methods of finance, in which he preferred loans to increased taxation, thereby burdening posterity, as others have done since. He chose to incur gigantic debts and to struggle haphazardly through each year until the dismal close of the campaigning season, living from day to day and hoping for the best. But if Pitt was an indifferent war minister, his successors were no improvement. Indeed, with all his defects, William Pitt stood high above his contemporaries. Certainly he held more popular confidence than any other man. He possessed perseverance and courage, and never flinched from criticism. In ringing tones and well-turned oratory, he retorted upon his opponents. "He, Mr. Fox, defies me to state in one sentence what is the object of the war. I know not whether I can do it in one sentence, but in one word I can tell him that it is security. Security against a danger, the greatest that ever threatened the world. It is security against a danger which never existed in any past period of society. It is security against a danger which in degree and extent was never equalled, against a danger which threatened all the nations of the earth, against a danger which has been resisted by all the nations of Europe, and resisted by none with so much success as by this nation, because by none has it been resisted so uniformly and with so much energy." Pitt was succeeded by a pinchbeck coalition of King's friends and rebels from his own party. Masquerading as a government of national union, they blundered on for over 3 years. Their leader was Henry Addington, an amiable former Speaker of the House of Commons, whom no one regarded as a statesman. As the young George Canning, a rising hope of the Tories, put it in jesting rhyme, "As London is to Paddington, so is Pitt to Addington." Wartime conditions demanded some form of coalition government. The Whig opposition, if only for their lack of administrative experience, were deemed unfit. In 1800, they'd been reduced to impotence by the transformation of the war from one against world revolution to one against world Caesarism. Until the rise of Bonaparte, they'd steadfastly pleaded for peace and understanding with the revolutionaries. Now they were reduced to points of strategy and military detail upon which they carried no authority. The sense of being the only possible national leader seems to have affected Pitt's actions remarkably little. Young men like Canning and Lord Castlereagh were trained in office under him, and they remained loyal to their chief. As Canning wrote, "Whether Pitt will save us, I do not know, but surely he is the only man that can." In March 1802, Addington's government made terms with Napoleon by the Treaty of Amiens, and for a time there was a pause in the fighting. Pitt supported the government over the peace, in spite of the arguments of some of his own followers. English tourists flocked to France, Fox among them, all eager to gaze upon the scenes of revolution and to see at first hand the formidable First Consul, as he now was. But the tourist season was short. In May of the following year, war was renewed and once more mismanaged. The administration had failed entirely to use the breathing space for improving the defences. Napoleon was now assembling his forces at Boulogne, intent upon the invasion of England. Pitt was in retirement at Walmer, in Kent. The strain of the past years had broken his health. He was prematurely aged. He'd lived a lonely, artificial life, cheered by few friendships. The only time that he ever came in contact with the people was during this brief interval from office, when, as warden of the Cinque-Ports, he organized the local militia against the threat of invasion. Few things in England's history are more remarkable than this picture of an ex-prime minister riding his horse at the head of a motley company of yokels drilling on the fields of the south coast, while a bare 20 miles away across the channel, the grand army of Napoleon waited only for a fair wind and a clear passage. Chapter 5. Trafalgar. In 1804, Pitt was recalled to power. Feverishly, he flung himself into the work of reorganizing England's war effort. Since the renewal of war, Britain had found herself alone against Napoleon, and for 2 years she maintained the struggle single-handed during one of the most critical periods in her history. Pitt's exertions eventually resulted in the creation of another coalition with Austria and Russia. But this took time. The French had for the moment cowed the continent into a passive acceptance of their mastery. The opportunity was now at hand to concentrate the whole weight of the armed forces of France against the stubborn islanders. Elaborate plans went forward to bring about their subjugation. An enormous army was organized and concentrated at the Channel ports for the invasion of England. A fleet of flat-bottomed boats was built to bring 200,000 men across the Channel to what seemed inevitable success. At the crest of his hopes, Napoleon had himself crowned by the Pope as Emperor of the French. One thing alone was lacking to his designs: command of the sea. It was essential to obtain naval control of the Channel before embarking upon such an enterprise. As before and since in her history, the Royal Navy alone seemed to stand between the island and national destruction. Its tasks were manifold. Day in, day out, winter and summer, British fleets kept blockade of the French naval bases of Brest and Rochefort on the Atlantic coast and Toulon in the Mediterranean. At all costs, a junction of the main French fleets must be prevented. The seas must be kept free for the trade and commerce upon which Britain's strength depended. Such French squadrons as occasionally escaped must be hunted down and sunk, or driven back to port. The western approaches to the English Channel must infallibly be guarded against French intrusion. Here was the rallying point for the far-flung British fleets when danger of invasion threatened the island, and here lay the main naval force under Admiral Cornwallis. As the American historian Admiral Mahan has said, "It was these distant, storm-beaten ships, upon which the Grand Army never looked, which stood between it and the dominion of the world." In May 1803, Nelson had returned to the Mediterranean to resume command of his fleet. Here the fate of his country might be decided. It was his task to contain the French fleet in Toulon and stop it from raiding Sicily and the eastern Mediterranean, or sailing into the Atlantic, whence it might lift the blockade of Rochefort and Brest, force the Channel, and cooperate with the Armada from Boulogne. Nelson was well aware of the grim significance of the moment, and all his brilliance as a commander was employed on creating a first-class machine. The crews were reorganized, the ships refitted under dangerous and difficult circumstances. He had no secure base from which to watch Toulon. Gibraltar and Malta were both too far away, and Minorca had been given back to Spain at the Treaty of Amiens. Provisions had to be brought from the coast towns of Sardinia and Spain, and when water ran out, he was forced each time to raise the blockade and move his whole force into Sardinian harbours. He was not even superior in numbers to the main French fleet in Toulon harbour. Under such circumstances, a literal hemming in of the French was impossible. Nelson's burning desire was to lure them out and fight them. Annihilation was his policy. He kept a screen of frigates watching Toulon, and himself with his battleships lay off Sardinia, alert for interception. Twice in the course of 2 years, the French attempted a sortie, but retired. Throughout this time, Nelson never set foot on shore. The constant nightmare in his mind revolved round the direction in which the French would make. For Sicily and Egypt, or Spain and the Atlantic? He had to cover all escape routes. In the centre of the web sat Napoleon, and the elaborate scheme for the final blow against England was slowly woven. But the vital instrument in his hand was brittle. The French navy had suffered a crushing blow in the days of the Revolution. With the breakdown of the finances, the existing ships had fallen into disrepair, and for some time no further additions were made to the fleet. The officer class had been almost wiped out on the guillotine. Discipline was bad, and the French navy in no state to play a decisive role. But strenuous efforts at recovery were made by Napoleon's Minister of Marine. New French commanders distinguished themselves in commerce raiding upon the oceans. In May 1804, the Emperor had confided the Toulon fleet to Admiral Villeneuve, an excellent seaman, who realized that his ships, except for the luck of circumstance, could only play a defensive part. Napoleon would brook no obstacles, and a complicated series of feints was worked out to deceive the British agents who swarmed into France to gather such information as they could. Spain was dragged into his schemes, her fleet being a necessary adjunct to the main plan. In the early months of 1805, Napoleon made his final arrangements. Over 90,000 assault troops, picked and trained, lay in the camps round Boulogne. The French channel ports were not constructed to take battleships, and the French fleets in the Atlantic and Mediterranean harbours must be concentrated elsewhere to gain command of the channel. The Emperor fixed upon the West Indies. Here, after breaking the Mediterranean and Atlantic blockades and drawing off the British fleet, as he thought, into the waters of the Western Atlantic, his ships were ordered to gather. The combined French and Spanish fleets would then unite with Gontaume, the admiral of the Brest squadron, double back to Europe, sail up the channel, and assure the crossing from Boulogne. The scheme was brilliant on paper, but it took no account of the state of the French ships, and it ignored the vital strategy of concentration always pursued by British admirals when the enemy was at large. Nelson was lying in wait off the Sardinian coastline in April 1805, when news reached him that Villeneuve was at sea, having slipped out of Toulon on the dark night of March the 30th, sailing, as Nelson did not yet know, in a westerly direction, with 11 ships of the line and 8 frigates. The Fox was out, and the chase began. Fortune seemed against Nelson. His frigates lost touch with Villeneuve, and he had first to make sure that the French were not running for Sicily and the Near East. This done, he headed for Gibraltar. Fierce westerly gales prevented him reaching the straits until May the 4th, when he learnt that Villeneuve had passed through to Cadiz more than 3 weeks before. 6 Spanish battleships had come out to join him, and the long voyage across the Atlantic began. Nelson, picking up scattered reports from frigates and merchantmen, pieced together the French design. All his qualities were now displayed to the full. Out of perplexing, obscure, and conflicting reports, he'd fathomed the French plan. There was no evidence to show that Villeneuve had gone to the north, and there could hardly be any reason for his sailing south along the West African coast. Therefore, on May the 11th, Nelson made the momentous decision to sail westwards himself. He had 10 ships of the line to follow 17 of the enemy. The passage was uneventful. In stately procession, at an average rate of 5.5 knots, the English pursued their quarry, and a game of hide-and-seek followed among the West Indian islands. Villeneuve and his Spanish allies reached Martinique on May the 14th. Nelson made landfall at Barbados on June the 4th. False intelligence led him to miss Villeneuve in the Caribbean seas. Meanwhile, news of his arrival alarmed the French admiral, who was promptly out again in the Atlantic by June the 8th, heading east. On the 12th, Nelson lay off Antigua, where Villeneuve had lain only 4 days earlier. He again had to make a crucial decision. Was he right in believing that the French were making for Europe? As he wrote in a dispatch, "So far from being infallible like the Pope, I believe my opinions to be very fallible, and therefore I may be mistaken that the enemy's fleet has gone to Europe. But I cannot think myself otherwise, notwithstanding the variety of opinions which a number of good people have formed." Before leaving the islands, Nelson sent a fast sloop back to England with dispatches, and on June the 19th it passed Villeneuve's fleet, noting his course and position. The commander of the sloop saw that Villeneuve was heading northeastwards for the Bay of Biscay, and raced home, reaching Plymouth on July the 8th. Lord Barham, the new First Lord of the Admiralty, aged 78 and with a lifetime's naval experience, at once realized what was happening. Nelson was sailing rapidly eastwards after Villeneuve, believing he would catch him at Cadiz and head him off the straits, while the French fleet was making steadily on a more northerly course, in the direction of Cape Finisterre. Villeneuve intended to release the Franco-Spanish squadron blockaded at Ferrol, and thus, reinforced, join with Gontaume from Brest. But Gontaume, in spite of peremptory orders from Napoleon, failed to break out. Admiral Cornwallis's fleet in the western approaches kept him in port. Meanwhile, on orders from Barham at the Admiralty, Admiral Calder intercepted Villeneuve off Finisterre, and here, in late July, the campaign of Trafalgar opened. Calder's action was indecisive, and the French took refuge in Ferrol. Nelson, meanwhile, had reached Cadiz on July the 18th. There he found Collingwood on guard, but no sign of the enemy. Realizing that Villeneuve must have gone north, Nelson replenished his fleet in Morocco and sailed for home waters on the 23rd. On the same day, Napoleon arrived at Boulogne. The crisis was at hand, and the outlying squadrons of the Royal Navy instinctively gathered at the mouth of the channel for the defence of the island. Calder joined Cornwallis off Brest on August the 14th, and on the next day Nelson arrived with 12 more ships, bringing the main fleet up to a total of nearly 40 ships of the line. Thus was the sea barrier concentrated against the French. Nelson went on alone with his flagship, the Victory, to Portsmouth. In the following days, the campaign reached its climax. Villeneuve sailed again from Ferrol on August the 13th in an attempt to join Gontaume and enter the English Channel, for Napoleon still believed that the British fleets were dispersed and that the moment had come for invasion. On August the 21st, Gontaume was observed to be leaving harbour, but Cornwallis closed in with his whole force, and the French turned back. Meanwhile, Villeneuve, having edged out into the Atlantic, had changed his mind. Well aware of the shortcomings of his ill-trained fleet, desperately short of supplies, and with many sick on board, he had abandoned the great adventure on August the 15th, and was already speeding south to Cadiz. The threat of invasion was over. Early in September, dispatches reached London telling that Villeneuve had gone south. Nelson, summoned from his home at Merton, was at once ordered to resume his command. "I hold myself ready to go forth whenever I am desired," he wrote, "although God knows I want rest." Amid scenes of enthusiasm, he rejoined the Victory at Portsmouth and sailed on September the 15th. All England realized that her fate now lay in the hands of this frail man. A fortnight later, he joined the fleet off Cadiz, now numbering 27 ships of the line. "We have only one great object in view," he wrote to Collingwood, that of annihilating our enemies. His object was to starve the enemy fleet, now concentrated in Cadiz Harbour, and force it out into the open sea and to battle. This involved patrolling the whole adjacent coast. He organized his own ships into blockading squadrons. His energy and inspiration roused the spirit of his captains to the highest pitch. To them he outlined a new and daring plan of battle. He intended to ignore the Admiralty's fighting instructions. To gain a decisive victory, he was resolved to abandon the old formal line of battle running parallel to the enemy's fleet. He would break Villeneuve's line, when it came out of port, by sailing at right angles, boldly into it with two main divisions. While the enemy van was thus cut off and out of touch, his centre and rear would be destroyed. After his conference with his captains, Nelson wrote, "All approved. It was new, it was singular, it was simple. It must succeed." In a mood of intense exhilaration, the fleet prepared for the ordeal ahead. Meanwhile, Villeneuve had received orders to sail for Naples in support of Napoleon's new military plans. After learning that he was about to be superseded, he resolved to obey before his successor could arrive. On the morning of October the 19th, a frigate signalled to Nelson's flagship, "Enemy has their topsail yards hoisted," and sometime later, "Enemy ships are coming out of port." On receiving these messages, Nelson led his fleet to the southeast to cut off the enemy from the straits and force them to fight in the open sea. At daybreak on the 21st, he saw from the quarterdeck of the Victory the battle line of the enemy, consisting of an advance squadron of 12 Spanish ships under Admiral Gravina and 21 French ships of the line under Villeneuve. It was 7 months since the escape from Toulon, and the first time that Nelson had seen his foes since war had begun again in 1803. The British fleet lay about 10 miles west of the enemy to the windward, and at 6 in the morning, Nelson signalled his ships to steer east-northeast for the attack in the two columns he'd planned. The enemy turned northwards on seeing the advancing squadrons, and Nelson pressed on with every sail set. The clumsy seamanship of his men convinced Villeneuve that flight was impossible, and he hove to in a long, sagging line to await Nelson's attack. The English admiral turned to one of his officers. "They have put a good face on it, but I will give them such a dressing as they have never had before." Nelson signalled to Collingwood, who was at the head of the southern column in the Royal Sovereign, "I intend to pass through the van of the enemy's line, to prevent him getting into Cadiz." Nelson went down to his cabin to compose a prayer. "May the great God whom I worship grant to my country, and for the benefit of Europe in general, a great and glorious victory. For myself, I commit my life to him who made me, and may his blessing light upon my endeavours for serving my country faithfully." The fleets were drawing nearer and nearer. Another signal was run up upon the Victory. "England expects every man will do his duty." When Collingwood saw the flutter, he remarked testily, "I wish Nelson would stop signalling. We all know well enough what we have to do." But when the message was reported to him, cheers broke out from the ships in his line. A deathly silence fell upon the fleet as the ships drew nearer. Each captain marked down his adversary, and within a few minutes the two English columns thundered into action. The roar of broadsides, the crashing of masts, the rattle of musketry at point-blank range rent the air. The Victory smashed through between Villeneuve's flagship, the Bucentaure, and the Redoutable. The three ships remained locked together, raking each other with broadsides. Nelson was pacing as if on parade on his quarterdeck, when at 1:15 p.m. he was shot from the masthead of the Redoutable by a bullet in the shoulder. His backbone was broken, and he was carried below amid the thunder of the Victory's guns. The battle was still raging. By the afternoon of October the 21st, 1805, 18 of the enemy ships had surrendered, and the remainder were in full retreat. 11 entered Cadiz, but 4 more were captured off the coast of Spain. In the log of the victory occurs the passage, "Partial firing continued until 4:30, when a victory having been reported to the Right Honourable Lord Viscount Nelson, K.B., and Commander-in-Chief, he then died of his wound." The victory was complete and final. The British fleet, under her most superb commander, like him, had done its duty. Napoleon, meanwhile, was attracted to other fields. When Villeneuve that summer failed to break through into the Channel, the Emperor made a sudden change of plan. He determined to strike at the European coalition raised against him by Pitt's diplomacy and subsidies. In August 1805, the camp at Boulogne broke up, and the French troops set out on their long march to the Danube. The campaign that followed wrecked Pitt's hopes and schemes. In the month of Trafalgar, the Austrian, General Mack, surrendered at Ulm. Austria and Russia were broken at the Battle of Austerlitz. Napoleon's star had once more triumphed, and for England all was to do again. About this time, the Prime Minister gave audience to a young general home from India. In forthright terms, this officer noted his opinion of Pitt. "The fault of his character," he wrote, "is being too sanguine. He conceives a project, then imagines it is done." This severe but not inaccurate judgment was formed by one who was to have many dealings with the armies of the French Emperor. His name was Arthur Wellesley, later Duke of Wellington. A personal sorrow now darkened Pitt's life. The House of Commons, by the casting vote of the Speaker, resolved to impeach his close colleague and lifelong companion, Henry Dundas, now Lord Melville, for maladministration in the Admiralty and for the peculations of certain of his subordinates. The decisive speech against Dundas was made by none other than Wilberforce. The scene in the House of Commons was poignant. Pitt's eyes filled with tears as he listened to Wilberforce attacking his other greatest friend. After the adverse decision, the opposition crowded round him to see how Pitt took it, but, encircled by his supporters, he was led from the House. It was this disgrace, rather than the news of Austerlitz, which finally broke the spirit and energy of the Prime Minister. In January 1806, he died. Wilberforce has written a valediction for his friend. "The time and circumstances of his death were peculiarly affecting. I really never remember any event producing so much apparent feeling, for a clear and comprehensive view of the most complicated subject in all its relations. For the fairness of mind which disposes a man to follow out, and when overtaken to recognize, the truth. For magnanimity which made him ready to change his measures when he thought the good of the country required it, though he knew he should be charged with inconsistency on account of the change. For willingness to give a fair hearing to all that could be urged against his own opinions, and to listen to the suggestions of men whose understanding he knew to be inferior to his own. For personal purity, disinterestedness, integrity, and love of his country, I have never known his equal." "In an age," runs the inscription on his monument in Guildhall, "when the contagion of ideals threatened to dissolve the forms of civil society, he rallied the loyal, the sober-minded, and the good around the venerable structure of the English monarchy." This is a fitting epitaph. Chapter 6. The Emperor of the French. William Pitt's successors were staunch in the prosecution of war, but even less adept at it than he. The 3 years between the death of Pitt in January 1806 and the rise of Wellington in 1809 were uncheered by fortune. England's military strength was wasted in unfruitful expeditions to the fringes of the Mediterranean coastline. One small victory was won at Maida in the Kingdom of Naples. There the rush of French attack was first broken by steady British infantry. Accounts of the battle reached Sir Arthur Wellesley in England, and fortified his views on how to meet the French in the field. but Maida was of no strategic consequence. An ambitious plan to gain a permanent foothold in the Spanish colonies of South America led to the temporary occupation of Buenos Aires and the ultimate loss of valuable forces. Thanks to the fleet, the sea lanes of the world remained open, and in Europe the important islands of Sicily and Sardinia were kept from Napoleon's grasp. In 1806 and 1807, there was a brief Ministry of All the Talents under Lord Grenville. The talent was largely provided by the Whigs, now in office for the first time since 1783, and the last until 1830. Over 20 years of divorce from power had had an insidious and lowering effect upon the party. Their organization and their program dissolved in the perplexed bickering of their leaders. The renewal of the European conflict quenched the hopes of parliamentary reform, upon which they'd taken their stand in the early 1790s. The rise of Napoleon destroyed their chance of effective opposition to the war. They'd maintained a straggling and futile fire against the strategic proposals of the government. They hoped now to lift some of the restrictions upon Roman Catholics, for they were much oppressed by the problem of Ireland. But in this they failed. The Secretary of State for War, William Wyndham, produced admirable paper reforms of the army. He recommended short-time service with increased pay. Abolishing the local militia, he passed a training act, which made universal military service compulsory. The manhood of England would be called to the colours in batches of 200,000 at a time. This was a striking piece of legislation. But in practical administration, Wyndham was less successful. "He is a most wretched man of business," remarked Wilberforce. "No precision or knowledge of details, even in his own measures." The government's tenure of office was redeemed by Fox's abolition of the slave trade, a measure which ranks among the greatest of British achievements, and from which Pitt had always shrunk. It was Fox's last effort. For 40 years, his warm-hearted eloquence had inspired the Whigs. Almost his whole parliamentary life was spent in opposition. He died as Secretary of State 9 months after his great rival Pitt had gone to the grave. In 1807, the Whigs fell. They were succeeded by a mixed government of Tory complexion under the nominal leadership of the Duke of Portland. Its object was to hold together the loyalties of as much of the nation as it could command. In this it was remarkably successful. New figures were appearing in the Tory ranks, trained by Pitt in the daily business of government. George Canning, Spencer Perceval, Viscount Castlereagh were reaching out for power. Politics centred on the conduct of the War Office and on the personal enmity and rivalry of Canning and Castlereagh. These restless spirits soon impelled the government to discard the strategies of William Pitt. Active participation in the military and naval struggle for Europe became the order of the day. Speed was essential, for Napoleon was reaching the height of his career. At Austerlitz, he'd struck down Russia and Austria. He was already master of the Netherlands, Italy, and the States of the Rhine. At Jena, a year later, he had broken Prussia. He became master of the whole country. For the next 7 years, French garrisons held Berlin and all important Prussian places. The Tsar was still in the field, but in June 1807, the Russian army was defeated at Friedland. There followed the reconciliation of Napoleon and Alexander. On a raft upon the Niemen, with their armies gathered on either bank, the two emperors met and embraced. Peace was made between them. And not only peace, but alliance. Alexander, estranged from England by the paltry support he'd received, yielded himself to Napoleon's spell. The two potentates planned Europe according to their common interests. Alexander had his moments of revolt. When he reviewed the French army and at Napoleon's side watched the old guard march past, he was struck by the scars and wounds which many of these veterans bore. "And where are the soldiers who have given these wounds?" he exclaimed to Ney. "Sire, they are dead." The Franco-Russian alliance, signed at Tilsit on July the 7th, was the culmination of Napoleon's power. He dominated all Europe. The Emperor of Austria was a cowed and obsequious satellite. The King of Prussia and his handsome queen were beggars, and almost captives in his train. Napoleon's brothers reigned as kings at The Hague, at Naples, and in Westphalia. His stepson ruled northern Italy in his name. Spain lent itself to his system, trusting that worse might not befall. Denmark and Scandinavia made haste to obey. Russia, the great counterpoise, had swung over to his side. Only Britannia remained, unreconciled, unconquered, implacable. There she lay in her island, mistress of the seas and oceans, ruled by her proud, stubborn aristocracy, facing this immense combination alone, sullen, fierce, and almost unperturbed. Some anxious merchants and manufacturers complained of the British blockade, which materially affected their interests. They stirred up Whig politicians to denounce it. But the government was founded on land, not trade, and turned a deaf ear. Nevertheless, Britain owed much of the power that was to bring her victory to her growing industrial supremacy. Industry knew this. The seeds were now sown for a crop of post-war troubles in which industry was to demand a greater share in the councils of the nation. But for the time being, patriotism healed all. Or nearly all. It was against this contumacious land, which marred and derided the unity of Europe and challenged the French peace, that Napoleon now directed his whole strength. To venture upon salt water, except for cruiser raids on commerce, was to be sunk or captured. The British blockade wrapped the French Empire and Napoleon's Europe in a clammy shroud. No trade, no coffee, no sugar, no contact with the East or with the Americans. And no means of ending the deadlock. Napoleon had believed that the marshalling of all Europe under his hands would force England to make terms. But no response came from the island, which throve upon seaborne trade, and whose ruling classes seemed to take as much interest in prize-fighting and fox-hunting as in the world crisis. Grave and threatening news was conveyed to London from the raft where the two emperors had met upon the River Niemen. An English secret agent reported that an arrangement had been reached whereby Napoleon was to seize the Danish fleet and gain control of the entrance to the Baltic. This was to be a preliminary to a joint invasion of England with the help of the Russians. The cabinet acted with praiseworthy decision. Admiral Gambier was immediately ordered to enter the Baltic with 20 ships of the line and procure, by force if necessary, the surrender of the Danish fleet. After a heavy action in the harbour of Copenhagen, the Danes yielded to this humiliation. This act of aggression against a neutral state aroused a storm against the government in Whig political and literary circles. But events vindicated the promptitude and excused the violence of their action. 2 days after the British fleet left home waters, Napoleon had informed the Danish minister in Paris that if England were to refuse Russian mediation in the Great War, Denmark would be forced to choose sides. Had the British government not acted with speed, the French would have been in possession of the Danish navy within a few weeks. At the War Office, Castlereagh was busy attempting to reorganize the regular army. This was done by drastic and immediate legislation. 30,000 men were drawn from the local militia, which had been restored, and formed into regular regiments, and provision was made to raise 44,000 recruits for the militia to take their place in home defense. Secure throughout the rest of Europe, Napoleon turned his attention to the Spanish peninsula. Powerless at sea, he realized that to destroy his one outstanding rival, he must turn the weapon of blockade against the island. English goods must be kept out of the markets of Europe by an iron ring of customs guards stretching from the borders of Russia, round the coasts of northern Europe and western France, and sealing the whole Mediterranean coastline as far as the Dardanelles. Napoleon proclaimed his policy from Berlin. It was a land blockade of sea power. The weakest link in the immense barrier of French troops and customs officers was the peninsula of Spain. To complete this amazing plan, it was essential to control not only Spain, but also Portugal, the traditional ally of Britain, whose capital, Lisbon, was an important potential base for the British fleet. The crucial point, therefore, lay in the peninsula. Slowly the minds of English ministers turned to this theatre of coming war. Napoleon was determined to strike through Spain at Lisbon before the British fleet could sail southwards. Canning, in charge of the Foreign Office, displayed the energy of youth. An English squadron sailed to the Tagus, collected the Portuguese ships, and packed off the Portuguese royal family, government, and society to the safety of Brazil. A few days later, Marshal Junot entered the Portuguese capital, and the following day, Napoleon declared war on the country he'd just occupied. France and Britain were now locked in their deadliest grip. In reply to Napoleon's continental system, the British government issued an order in council declaring a sea blockade of all French and French-allied ports. In other words, of almost the whole of Europe. Napoleon's decrees and the English orders wounded the merchant shipping of the neutral countries. The results of this trade war were far-reaching for both sides. The commerce of Europe was paralysed, and the nations stirred beneath the French yoke. Interference by British ships with neutral vessels raised with the United States the question of the freedom of the seas. It was a grievous dispute, not to be settled without recourse to war. Napoleon, insatiable of power, and seeking always to break England and her intangible blockade, resolved to seize the Spanish crown. He enticed King Charles IV of Spain and his son Ferdinand into a trap at Bayonne, and under the threat of a firing squad, compelled them to sign documents of abdication. He placed his own brother Joseph on the throne of Spain as a vassal of the French Empire. He was overjoyed with the success of this violence. "Spanish opinion bends to my will. Tranquility is everywhere re-established," he wrote to Cambaceres, and to his foreign secretary, Talleyrand, on May 16, 1807, "The Spanish business goes well, and will soon be entirely settled." But, happily for human freedom, things are not so easy as that. As soon as the Spaniards realized what had happened, and that their country was practically annexed to France, they rose everywhere in spontaneous revolt. Between May the 24th and 30th, in every hamlet and village throughout the peninsula, they took up what arms they could find and set out for the capital of the province, or their local centre, where the same process was already working on a larger scale. Nothing like this universal uprising of a numerous ancient race and nation, all animated by one thought, had been seen before. The tiny province of Asturias on the Biscayan shore, separated by the mountains from the rest of Spain, knowing nothing of what the rest were doing, drove out the French governor, seized the arsenal with booty of 100,000 muskets, constituted itself an independent government, declared war upon Napoleon at the height of his greatness, and sent their envoys to England to appeal for alliance and aid. The envoys landed at Falmouth on the night of June the 6th, and were conveyed by the Admiralty to Canning. Canning understood. From that moment, the Peninsular War began. For the first time, the forces unchained by the French Revolution, which Napoleon had disciplined and directed, met not kings or old-world hierarchies, but a whole population inspired by the religion and patriotism which Joan of Arc had tried in vain to teach to France, and now Spain was to teach to Europe. The character of the warfare darkened. In Germany and Italy and elsewhere, there had been pillage and rough deeds. But the armies had given quarter, and the inhabitants had remained spectators. Now, in Spain, the French troops found as they marched the corpses of their stragglers and wounded, often horribly mutilated, sometimes bearing signs of torture. It was with a chill that they realized they were at grips with a foe who, though incompetent in a set battle, neither gave nor sought mercy. Moreover, this foe lay everywhere. In July, King Joseph wrote to Napoleon from Madrid. "No one has told the truth so far. The fact is that there is not a single Spaniard who is for me, except the few who came here with me. All are terrorized by the unanimous feelings of their compatriots." And he called for plenty of troops and money. The Emperor was very slow to measure the force of the Spanish revolt. He'd been warring in Europe for 15 years, and he thought he understood the sort of things that happened and their values. He conceived himself a liberator, as indeed he was in many parts of the continent. He could not understand a people who preferred misgovernment of their own making to rational rule imposed from without. Now, at the end of July, news reached him at the Tuileries of an event in Spain, grave in itself and menacing to the whole structure of his power. General Dupont, withdrawing to Madrid from Cordova, had been entangled and brought to a standstill at Bailen in Andalusia. In the burning summer, he had to fight for water, and not gaining it, surrendered to the Spanish insurgents with 22,000 French soldiers. This was a new event in Europe since the Revolutionary Wars began. Napoleon felt himself smitten in a manner deadly to his system. The capitulation of Bailen compelled the evacuation of Madrid. The French army, carrying King Joseph with them, withdrew to the northeast behind the Ebro. Marshal Junot, in Portugal, whose people had likewise risen en masse, was isolated by hundreds of miles of hostile country and by the salt seas where Britain ruled, and from which she could strike. Napoleon felt in every nerve and fibre the tremor which ran through Europe and jarred the foundations of his imperial throne. Here and now he was strong enough to quit Spain. His power would still have been enormous. But he feared to retreat from a false and dangerous position. He must move, like all dictators, from one triumph to another. This country, which he had expected to incorporate in his empire by a personal arrangement with a feeble government, by trick, by trap, without bloodshed or expense, suddenly became his main military problem. He resolved to conquer. He reached out to Germany and drew the flower of his armies to the south. He prepared to fill their places by anticipating the conscription of the year 1809, and moved 160,000 recruits through his depots, gradually forward to their posts in Germany and through Austria, about whose attitude he already felt misgivings. The veterans marched through France into Spain. Their journey was made agreeable. They were officially fêted and feasted in all the French towns through which they passed. The soldiers were cheered by the kindness of the people. The people were impressed by the spectacle of the Emperor's glorious army. But meanwhile, the English had struck a shrewd blow. Canning and his colleagues decided to send an army to the peninsula to aid the Spanish insurgents. But as the juntas of Galicia and Andalusia were not as yet willing to accept foreign troops, the expedition was sent to Portugal, and in July 1808 disembarked north of Lisbon in the Mondego River. This small British army consisted of 30,000 well-equipped men. At the head of the first troops to land appeared Sir Arthur Wellesley, whose conduct of the Mahratta War in India had been distinguished. He had gained the Battle of Assaye. He was the younger brother of the Governor-General of India. He was a member of Parliament and of the Tory administration, and actually held office at this time as Chief Secretary to the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. He did not wait for the rest of the army, but immediately took the field. At the combat at Rolisa, Junot received a sharp repulse. At Vimiero, this was repeated on a larger scale. The French columns of assault were broken by the reserved fire of the Thin Red Line, which now began to attract attention. Junot retreated upon Lisbon. Sir Arthur Wellesley was superseded in the moment of victory by the arrival of Sir Harry Burrard, who later in the same day made over his command to Sir Hugh Dalrymple. Wellesley's wish to seize the pass of Torres Vedras and thus cut Junot's line of retreat was frustrated by his seniors. But the French commander now sent Kellerman to the British camp to negotiate. He offered to evacuate Portugal if the British would carry him back to France. The Convention of Fintra was signed and punctiliously executed by the British. Junot and 26,000 Frenchmen were landed from British transports at Rochefort. Wellesley, in dudgeon, remarked to his officers, "We can now go and shoot red-legged partridges." There was a loud and not unnatural outcry in England at Junot being freed. A military court of inquiry in London exonerated the three commanders, but only one of them was ever employed again. He was the one that mattered. Sir Arthur and Sir Harry and Sir Hugh, sing cock-a-doodle-doodle, doodle-doodle-doo. Sir Arthur was a fighting cock, but of the other two, sing doodle-doodle-doodle, doodle-doodle-doo. Napoleon had intended to court-martial Junot, but as the English were trying their own generals, he declared himself glad not to have to proceed against an old friend. History has endorsed Byron's line, "Britannia sickens, Thintra, at thy name." Napoleon now moved a quarter of a million of his best troops into Spain. While the Grand Army was gathering behind the Ebro, he organized a mighty display. At Erfurt, an imposing reunion of all his tributaries and allies was convened. 38 princes and rulers assembled at the Emperor's call. When the Tsar arrived, Napoleon sought to inflame his mind with schemes of a Franco-Russian march to Constantinople and beyond, along the historic route to India. Alexander was still fascinated by Napoleon's personality. He liked to dream of world conquest with him. But he was also vexed by the large garrisons Napoleon kept on the Oder. Talleyrand, by subtle whispers, betrayed Napoleon's interest, urging the Tsar to unite himself with France rather than with its emperor. All passed off with pomp and splendor. Alexander and Napoleon kissed each other before the august circle. But Erfurt was only a hollow echo of Tilsit. The moment had now come for Napoleon to take command on the Ebro. An avalanche of fire and steel broke upon the Spanish juntas who, with 90,000 raw but ardent volunteers, had nursed a brief illusion of freedom regained. The emperor advanced upon Madrid, driving the Spanish army before him in a series of routs, in which the French cavalry took pitiless vengeance. He astonished his personal staff by his violent energy. Always with the leading troops, he forced the fighting, even at Somosierra, making his own bodyguard charge the batteries, regardless of loss. In December, he entered Madrid, and replaced Joseph, who had hitherto followed with the baggage train, upon the stolen throne. But the Spanish people were undaunted, and all around the camps of the victorious invaders flickered a horrible guerrilla. A new English general of high quality had succeeded the commanders involved in the Convention of Cintra. Sir John Moore advanced from Lisbon through Salamanca to Valladolid. He'd been lured by promises of powerful Spanish assistance, and he tried, by running great risks, to turn Spanish hopes into reality. His daring thrust cut or threatened the communications of all the French armies, and immediately prevented any French action in the south of Spain or against Portugal. But Napoleon, watching from Madrid, saw him a prey. At Christmas, 1808, with 50,000 men, with Ney, Soult, and the Old Guard, he marched to intercept and destroy him. On foot with his soldiers, Napoleon tramped through the snows of the Guadarrama. He moved with amazing speed. Moore, warned in time and invoking amphibious power, dropped his communications with Portugal and ordered his transports to meet him at Coruña, on the northwest tip of Spain. It was a race. But when the French horse crossed the Rio Seco, they were hurled back, and their general captured by the cavalry of the English rearguard. Moore had already passed Astorga and was halfway to his haven. At Astorga, the emperor sat down on the parapet of a bridge to read dispatches brought apace from the capital. After a few moments he rose and stood absorbed in thought. Then, ordering up his travelling coach, he handed over the pursuit of the British to Soult, and without offering any explanation to his officers, set off for Valladolid and Paris. He'd known for some months that the Austrian armies were assembling, and he must expect an Austrian declaration of war. But his summons home was more intimate. His brother Lucien and his stepson Eugène de Beauharnais warned him of an intrigue or even a plot against him by Talleyrand and Fouché, his minister of police. Besides, there was now no chance of cutting off the British. The pursuit had become a stern chase. Soult and Ney could have it. The retreat of the British through the rugged, snow-bound hill country was arduous. The French pressed heavily. Scenes of mass drunkenness where wine stores were found, pillage, stragglers dying of cold and hunger, and the army chest of gold flung down a precipice to baffle capture, darkened the British track. But when at Lugo, Moore turned and offered battle, his army showed so firm a posture that for 2 days Soult, although already superior, awaited reinforcements. It was now resolved to slip away in the night to Coruña, where the army arrived on January the 14th, 1809. But the harbour was empty. Contrary winds had delayed the fleet and transports. There would be a battle after all. On the 16th, Soult assaulted Moore with 20,000 against 14,000. He was everywhere repulsed, and indeed counter-attacked. When darkness fell, the pursuers had had enough. But both Sir John Moore and his second-in-command, Sir David Baird, had fallen on the field. Moore's death and burial have been recorded in famous prose and verse. "From the spot where he fell," wrote Napier, who fought in the action, "the general was carried to the town by a party of soldiers. The blood flowed fast, and the torture of his wound increased. But such was the unshaken firmness of his mind that